Hello, and thanks for finding My Cape York Life, a podcast about the people who live on and care for Cape York. I'm Lyndall Scoble from Cape York Natural Resource Management. My Cape York Life shares the stories of the resilient people who live and work in one of the world's most remote, diverse and stunning locations.
When my boys were teenagers, we spent a lot of time canoeing on the creeks around here and doing annual trips down the Mitchell River, going from Cooktown Crossing down to calmer waters. It used to take us 4 or 5 days, and it was just wonderful.
I've been here for 70 years. My home was at Musgrave, and our team is 15 miles south of Musgrave. So in my lifetime, I more or less moved 15 miles south.
I can't begin to imagine the connection that traditional owners have with country, but I certainly get a feeling as I hit that area. Something akin to it, I think. Just worries fall away and feel lighter and different. And I love working to protect this amazing place because it deserves it.
If you live on the Cape, maybe you've visited or have a dream to one day roll out your swag here, My Cape York Life is for you. You can stream us at landmanager.capeyorknrm.com.au or download us on your favourite podcast app. My Cape York Life comes to you from Cape York Natural Resource Management with the support of the Australian Government's National Landcare Program. This time we meet Alan Wilson, who's lived and worked on Cape York for almost 40 years. Alan's done many things in his time: representative sport, surf life saving. He's served in both the Queensland and Northern Territory police forces. Alan has managed Cape York cattle stations. He ran the Quinkin pub at Laura and the Laura Roadhouse. Since 2004, Alan has been a councillor with Cook Shire Council, where his tireless work for better ways to manage rubbish has led to Queensland introducing a refund scheme for recyclable containers. Alan lives at Laura, but we caught up at the beautiful Cooktown Botanic Gardens to talk about his many adventures on the Cape.
My name's Alan Wilson. I'm a Cookshire councillor, serving my fourth term with the council. Well, we're in a natural hardwood sort of semi-rainforest at the Botanical Gardens at Cooktown. It's a beautiful spot with lots of birds and green shrubbery.
Alan, you said that your fourth term on the Cookshire Council. So how many years is that about?
We're going into our 14th year. So by the time I finish, I think it'll be about 16 years all up.
By the time you finish? So what does that mean?
This is my last term. I feel it's time for younger people to take a more active position. I think this is happening in our present council.
So, Alan, how many years have you been actually in this area and on Cape York?
About 38 years in Lakeland, Laura area.
Okay, and whereabouts were you from before that?
I originated in Mackay, where I was born, on property. And I worked in that area on cane farms and cutting cane in the early days by hand. And later I became involved in sport in Mackay, and I played several different sports, which I was, had the great honour of representing Mackay on all of them. And I later then became a member of the Queensland Police Force for 5 years, after which I became a little dissatisfied in the force, and my father passed away, and I saw fit to move to the Northern Territory.
So before we get to the Northern Territory, I'm a little bit interested in you saying that you were cutting cane in the days where you cut cane by hand.
Yes, those were the days. I think I had 8 years. I left school very early in life, and I cut for 8 years by hand, and it was pretty hard work. In those days, we had Italians come out after the war. I cut in the gangs, the Italian gangs, and it was quite an experience.
Very hard work, I would imagine.
Yeah, it stretches your imagination to how those fellas can drink a bottle of vino and sing all day and keep cutting in the heat and the conditions we had to work in.
So tell us a little bit more about those conditions.
Well, those days we had to burn the cane, and of course that'd attract the bees. We didn't dress very well. We had bare feet, a pair of shorts on, that's all we wore. and an old straw hat most of the time, and a good cane knife. And we had a Mills Bastard file, which would keep our cane knife sharpened, and an old canvas water bag of water. And we'd cart along with us, and that was our uniform, I guess.
Alan, you were born in Mackay, is that right?
I was born north of Mackay, on a small property that my father owned a part of, which was part of Royston Park. All we had was a horse and sulky, and so my mother never ever made it to hospital when I was born. I just popped out on the side of a track. We were heading towards the main road where they were going to try and get an ambulance or a vehicle to get a lift into Mackay, which was about 30 miles away, and didn't quite make it. So I guess that's why I like to be in the bush.
Because you were born in the bush, on the side of the road.
Side of a bush track.
That makes a lot of sense now, Alan.
Yeah, that's why I suppose, I guess so, yeah.
And so you grew up then in Mackay. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yeah, two brothers and two sisters. The two brothers are deceased, and the two sisters, one lives in Brisbane, the other in Mackay.
From Mackay, you talked about joining the police force. Then you went to the Northern Territory. So what were you doing over in the Territory?
In the police force, the Northern Territory police force, you have to resign in Queensland and then rejoin in the Northern Territory. I enjoyed the service over there much better because it wasn't in a large city. I was in the bush and had the opportunity to work in the bush as a police officer.
So, Alan, it takes a special kind of person to serve in the police, to be a police officer. What was it that actually drew you towards that as a career to start with?
Well, I guess my grandfather was a police officer and my dad would have been, and he had an accident at 19. He has already signed up to go in, just waiting for a call-up, and he had an accident with a horse, fractured his spine.
So for you then, it was a bit of a family passion?
Dad always talked about it so much and all the good points and how his father used to be on the board of New South Wales and later on in Mackay, the different things that happened during his service. Yeah, I guess it was part of a career. And then I met a lot of police officers I played golf with, and they talked me into joining.
What were some of the challenges and some of the wonderful things about being in the police force?
Well, there's a good side and a bad side. Those days you could use a lot of common sense in how you carried out the laws of the land, how you implemented action to be taken against a person, whether you went ahead with it or you gave him a caution. I think today that's all been taken away from the present police officer, and he's too many regulations, there's too much overall supervision with cameras and tape recorders, and I think that's makes it far more difficult. I wouldn't like to be a policeman now.
And somewhere along the track, you decided to do a bit more with your, you know, your upbringing on land. You got into cattle work, some stock work.
Yes, when I left the Territory, I had an accident where I lost a couple of fingers on duty. And then I returned to Queensland, where I took up work in the Mareeba sale yard. And from there, I then took up the management of Lakeland Downs cattle. And I managed that herd prior to the subdivision of Lakeland.
So Lakeland Downs used to be a big cattle station, and it's sort of where the town is now, is that correct?
Yes, it used to be named initially Butcher's Hill, and then it was brought by Foyster, and they changed it to Lakeland Downs, and then was taken over by the Anderson family, GWA, Great Western Australia. They run it for quite a while, growing crops of peanuts and maize and sorghum. And then they saw fit to subdivide it, and then the town was called Lakeland. It's still, we only had a debate about this only a week or so ago in council as to whether it was really a town or not, and that's got to be ascertained. So it was just a change of naming, and it became the town of Lakeland, far as all the locals were concerned. And then it was subdivided, and the total herd was sold, and so my job then as cattle manager ended. So I then put in a plantation of coffee, which I knew nothing about other than putting it in a cup and out in hot water. We got 100 odd acres of coffee in, and which was quite successful.
Around what time was that? What year would that have been around?
Well, that was around 86 to 88 that I took part in that. And then I had enough of that. I wanted to go back with cattle and horses, and I owned a portion of Lakeland, which was Mount McLean. I used to do contract work in fencing out through the Gulf and up in the Cape. And I was then offered the position of manager of Olivevale Station, which I took up with the Doigro, the German company that owned.
Going back just a little bit, what year would it have been when you first came up to Lakeland?
I think it was 81.
Okay, so that's quite some years ago. So that makes us nearly 40 years on the Cape, is that right?
Nearly, yeah.
So Olivevale, can you tell us where that is?
Olivevale's just property just across the river from north of Laura, the township of Laura, and it goes approximately 45k up the highway, the Peninsula Development Road, and it was then about 1,000 square mile of country. It has been cut back slightly, and I think the present owners have brought an adjoining property, which makes it even bigger.
I'm just thinking about some of that work that you've done in those days of managing cattle stations and fencing contracting and that kind of work. You must have really seen some things, and you must have some pretty interesting stories from those days. Anything that that comes to mind that you'd like to share with us?
Some were pretty ticklish at the times. Things that happen in the bush and that. Yeah, like when you jump off a horse to throw a bull and you've got to look for a tree to climb. Sometimes you miscalculate whether the bull's been run enough and you jump off and he wheels around and wants to chase you. So
a lot of people listening to this might not have any idea what mustering involves, and particularly in a place like Cape York where you're pretty remote and, you know, the nearest hospital's actually 2 days away maybe then.
Yeah, it was pretty touchy. A lot of times you got it knocked around and you didn't go straight to any medical assistance. You just kept on carrying on. And a lot of blokes did that in the past, and they probably do it at present. Mustering those days, we used to take the camp out, take our swags and food and so forth. We'd set up a stock camp and work from there. I had 30-odd coaches, big bullocks. They used to feed out of my hand and they'd follow us around like dogs, and I'd take them out, put them in the yard, and then we'd use a helicopter on a lot of occasions, and the helicopter'd come out. We'd let the coaches out of the yards, and we'd muster into the coaches. And we'd go through the whole day, and then we'd yard at a water with a fence around it, paddock, at night, and yard the cattle and any of the clean skins. We'd yard them and at times try and truck them into the main station and camp the night and move on the next day. And this was just the process of getting around the majority of the out area of the station.
And what's the cattle country like on Cape York?
There's some beautiful cattle country there. A lot of it's now National Park, which is sad in a way. I'd like to have seen the top quality country left as cattle stations for especially the Indigenous to operate in a viable manner, and just take the areas that were relevant to cultural purposes, and that could have been cut off for that purpose, I think, and made national parks or whatever. Mm. But I feel that there's so much good land up there. It's just open plains, and it's just sad to see it going to waste.
Alan, when was it? So you've done quite a lot of work on stations up there. So when was it that you moved to council?
Well, I left Olivevale, I think, in 94. And then I went on a block I had up in the Tableland. I'd sold the block in Lakeland, went on the block up in the fattening block in the Tableland. As a result of family, I then sold that property and was doing odd work on stations. And I went back to Laura to take on the hotel. And that was in 1997. I took up the licence of the Quinken Hotel.
That must have been a pretty interesting time.
Oh, that was pretty good there. We used to have a fantastic time, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Laura, because it's a small town and it's a gorgeous little spot there.
Yeah, Laura's a town and it's a historical town, and the fact that it was one of the stopovers for the prospectors and miners that went from Cooktown across to Maytown. And the rail come from Cooktown in the 1880s, I think it arrived there, about 1885, 86, it arrived in Laura. And they built a bridge over the Laura River to head up the Mossman Gorge. And they put a test train over it, and that wet season, the bridge got washed away. So to a large extent, the gold had petered out. There's still gold up there. There's still a lot of gold being mined in the Maytown area, but not to the extent it used to be. So that gives Laura a real historical position in the Cape. And there's a lot of potential there. There's a lot of Aboriginal rock art. They're still finding it in the escarpments, locating new finds nearly every month or so up there, the Laura Ranges. So there's a lot of potential for tourism and being a stepping stone into the Cape and onto the national parks, which are just a very close proximity to Laura.
You loved it so much that you bought land there?
Yes, I had the hotel for about 6 years, and then due to a fire, I left the hotel, and I then had the roadhouse for another 6 years. That's a little BP cafe on the entrance into Laura.
Alan, I can remember you've told me some stories about the flood times of the Laura River, and there's a whole heap of photos, or you had lots of photos up from some of those times in the roadhouse?
Yes, yeah, so in the hotel and the roadhouse, every year the entrance into town over the southern crossing of the Laura River would flood, and then the outer highway out of Laura would flood. So you got two bridges. The town's built in the curve of the river, in the horseshoe of the river. And so people used to get stuck each side of town. In 1999, I brought a boat and a motor specifically for conveying people over the river. And we did that every wet season for quite a few years. And it was pretty hairy at times.
The bitumen road's only a fairly recent addition to get to Laura as well from the south, isn't it?
Yes, it was one of the things that I pushed for as a councillor, was to get that bridge over the Laura. It wasn't going to happen, and we just kept taking up petitions and so forth. And it'll be great when we get the northern one over too, because it is a pretty dangerous affair. Amazing that we haven't lost more lives there as a result of the wet season and the flood.
So tell me what the Laura's like in flood.
Well, the southern crossing wasn't as bad as the northern, with the one we still have at the moment. It runs very fast. The river narrows down there, and you also have the Mossman and a couple of other waterways come in between the two bridges. But the southern one was a wider flood area, a riverbed. It used to hold up longer. As you go around the horseshoe, there's a bottleneck. There's a chasm around there that blocks the water back, or seems to hold it back, so that the southern crossing stayed up longer than the northern. It's hard to believe that, but that used to happen.
When you look at that bridge now, and I think it was not long after it opened, did the water go over it?
No, it came up underneath within a metre of the top, and that's 18 metres high, that bridge.
18 metres high, that bridge?
Yes.
That's a lot of water.
Oh, yeah, we've actually seen it a little bit higher. I've seen it right up over the banks, and you had to actually cross another stream to get to it to see how high the river was.
So what year, you said, I mean, that was one of the things, getting the bitumen up to Laura and the bridge over the river was one of the things that you pushed for as a councillor. What year was it when you first became a councillor?
Oh, I think it's 2004.
When you've been on council for four terms, that's quite a journey, I think.
Yeah, it is a long time. I first went in with Bob Sullivan and our present mayor, Peter Scott. There's a lot of fellows who aren't on council. Peter and I are the only two that's left and that's continued on.
So what was it? What was your drive to become a councillor?
I was dissatisfied with the council and being a resident of Laura for quite a few years and trying to run a business. I just wanted to see a little bit more attention spent on the regional areas outside of Cooktown. And so that was the main reason I sat. And those days we had divisions so that you only had that area out there that you actually represented. That only went for one term. The other three terms, it's non-divisional.
Cookshire is a pretty big place, isn't it?
Yeah, it's roughly 106,000 square kilometres, and it really tests you out trying to keep in touch with everybody on it. It's a big area with very few people, and the worst of it is we don't have a very big rate base. Besides that, by a lot of the country going to national parks, not of the properties, that means we're reducing our rate base. We're not enlarging it. We're not getting enough new residents to counteract that.
So what impact does that have when you don't have enough ratepayers to, you know, you don't have that big rate space? So what? How does that impact a local government?
Well, to maintain infrastructure and services to the Shire, it's very difficult. You've got your hand out all the time to the government, and you don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to work out that they don't see Cape York or Cook Shire as a major supporter of population and so forth, enough votes here to give us too much money. They just keep us on a shoestring virtually.
So it's pretty challenging to get your infrastructure in place and maintain your council roads and all of those facilities?
Yeah, a prime example is the Nature's Powerhouse. The money was given to build it, but then they don't give you the money to run it and maintain it. And anything like that in this sort of environment takes a lot of cost to maintain it and in the manner it has to be done.
So Nature's Powerhouse is the facility that's within the botanical gardens where we're sitting here, and it's a bit of a cafe, it's a gallery, it's a collection of scientific and local history. Would that be a good way of describing it, and arts? And
yes, that's a good description. And there's certain artwork in there that has to be kept at a certain temperature, and it's a very specialist air conditioning setup, and costs a lot of money to maintain. And that's been an ongoing thing. It's like having a boil there that keeps on needing attention. We have other places like that now, the Civic Centre. It's great. It's a great building, but we have to maintain it, and it's just and where do you find the dollars for it? You've got to go for grants. You can't take it out of our reserves because we just don't have any.
So it's pretty tough being a local government here in the remote parts of the country.
It certainly is, and we've got a lot of people out there a long way from Cooktown who these facilities don't service very much, so they're saying, why don't we get some attention? Why aren't our roads up to scratch and our infrastructure? And you've got to, compensate them in some manner or form for the lack of the services they don't get.
Alan Wilson on the challenges of local government on Cape York Peninsula. Cookshire Council, on which Alan sits, is responsible for 80% of the Cape. That's 100,000 square kilometres, home to just 5,000 people. You're listening to My Cape York Life, stories about the people who live on and care for Cape York Peninsula. We're having a chat with Cookshire Councillor Alan Wilson, who says he's talked a lot of rubbish since he was first elected to council back in 2004. The comment is a tongue-in-cheek reference to his passion for finding better ways to manage waste, a major challenge in big cities and almost insurmountable in bush communities. But Alan's relentless efforts have borne fruit. He's been instrumental in convincing the Queensland Government to launch a refund scheme for recyclable containers. I'm talking to Alan in the Botanic Gardens at Cooktown. Alan, for a very long time, you have been campaigning across the state and probably nationally as well on recycling, container deposits and things like that. Do you want to talk to that a little bit, please?
Yeah, well, that goes back to a previous councillor whose portfolio was waste management. And then when he left, I took it on. After studying the cost of waste management just for Cooktown alone and for Cookshire overall, we're continually in the red every year. So the only way I can see that we can get on top of this is reduce the volume that we're handling and transporting. I grew up in an environment there was no rubbish, there's no cans, no bottles, no no plastic bags floating in the forest. I used to walk for miles in the forest hunting, and I'd never see a can, never see a bottle. And it makes you sick today when you walk through the bush, and if you're not kicking a bottle, you're kicking a can or you're seeing a plastic bag. And also up in the national park, we get people coming up from down south. They take their rubbish in, but they don't bring it back out. And I have photos of it, lots of slides of it, just showing you heaps of garbage. So that's not imagining things. It's a fair dinkum situation.
Absolutely.
And so I've been working out ways to get around this. And one of the ways is what we used to do as kids. We used to collect all the bottles, long neck bottles, and we'd take them in and we'd get enough money to go to the local agricultural show or buy a lollipop at the shop. Now that was all taken away as the throwaway society come in, and the only state that still has it was South Australia. So I went to South Australia. I spent a couple of weeks down there going through their system, and I worked on the territory is bringing it in there. So I worked with them and kept in contact with them. And 2006-2007, I went to NQLGA conference and put up a motion for plastic bags to be controlled and a container deposit scheme to be brought in.
How did that go down?
Well, up there, it was out of Flinders, I think, at a conference. It went across, everybody was behind it, and they said, no, we can't put it up together, we have to split it and the plastic bag go on their own. And we put that up. That's got a chance of getting through, but the other won't get through. So I kept at it. I later went over, had the opportunity to go to Germany with a friend, and he was doing research into waste management and composting, and I went to Sweden, Germany, and another trip I did to Spain, and I studied how they operated, their process they went through with their waste, everything from household waste right through to composting, etc., and recycling.
That's a fair bit of research that you've done along the way. So what did you learn?
I learned that we're so far behind Europe, it's just a joke. And we live in fantasy land here because we've got a lot of land. We seem to think that we can just dig a hole and put it in. Well, I can assure you that on two landfills in Switzerland, both sites become a disaster, and they had to excavate them at $1 billion American dollars each to excavate them and take all the material out, and all had to be tested, all had to be done in a sealed manner and form. The operators on the machinery had to be in air-conditioned cabs with oxygen kits on. That's how dangerous it can become when you put all these chemicals and materials together and you get the reaction between them. It was leaching into their lakes, and so they had to take the relevant action. Mm. And we saw this, and I have photos of it, and yeah, it's just a disaster. And we've got to think more clearly on what we're doing with our waste.
So you've got all this knowledge. What did you do with it?
Well, I come back and I kept on persevering with the government. I went to Newman's government with all my material, all the information I had.
That's the state government?
State government, sorry. Yep. Queensland state government. Yep. And first I went to the Bligh government and then to Newman. And then on the present government, Premier Palaszczuk and Dr. Stephen Miles, I gave them a copy of the file, all the information I put together, and said, please have a look at this, because I wasn't getting through LGAQ head office. They were just knocking it on the head. I was doing everything by the book, going through the council conferences, through Local Government Association of Queensland, and it wasn't getting there. So I did the other thing. Palaszczuk came to Cooktown, and I gave a copy for her and the environmental minister. And that eventually kicked off, and I received a call from Miles to say, we're going with it, you want to be on the works committee? And I said, yes, for sure.
So we're going with it. So what does that mean? What are they going for?
Well, it has. We've had workshops where we've put together legislation which went through on the 6th of, I think it was 6th of October. It passed through Parliament with unconditional support from all parties.
So what's passed through? What is
the bill? The bill for plastic bag control of plastic bags and the container refund scheme.
How exciting is that?
Yeah, well, that's the start of it. Then we have to go through and work out how it's going to be introduced. Yep. The bill went through, and then we had to get down to the real nitty-gritties of it and how it's going to be operated in a state the size of Queensland. New South Wales, they received a copy of my information through the channels. They asked me if they could have it, and I said yes, pass it on. And from one of the conferences, workshops, so they went as well. So now they've started on the first of this month. We're watching it closely as to how it goes through. It's a little bit different to the Queensland model, and I think ours is better in some areas, but we've got to watch for the pitfalls.
I think it's really exciting that that these things are sort of happening, starting to happen simultaneously, and we can learn from each other and see what works in New South Wales and maybe tweak the Queensland way of doing things and vice versa.
Yes, it's probably what the state government has done is slowed their operation down. So we come on the 1st of July next year, and West Australia's comes on board as well now, and they'll be starting at 1st of July next year, same as Queensland. So both West Australia and Queensland are watching New South Wales. Mm. We had South Australia been operating for 44 years, and our model is similar, but not the same. Mm. But it's as I've preached and preached that it had to be uniform across the country, otherwise it'll create confusion. So that's what we've done.
That's fantastic, Alan. You must be, you know, after so many years of, like 20 years probably, just about campaigning for this and working really, like, not just talking about it, but actually getting out there and doing the research and learning all about it. You must be feeling pretty satisfied that finally somebody's listened.
Yeah, I guess just about every shire in Queensland remember me as speaking up at conferences, and, you know, putting it up again and again to get it through eventually. Yeah, they called me Mr. Rubbish when they saw me coming, I think.
Well, that's not how we do see you as Mr. Rubbish, but we actually, you're our Mr. Rubbish here on Cape York in the Cookshire.
Yeah, well, I've been, since I took over the rubbish portfolio, the waste portfolio with Cookshire, I've been on LAWMAC, which is a local authority waste management advisory committee for North Queensland. Now, when I took it over, it started Mackay to Thursday Island and to Mount Isa. Now, Darwin's coming on as associate member, and Rockhampton and central Queensland and further south, the Highlands, they've come on as member, because we've been so proactive in going forward in trying to bring on new methods of waste control. And I've chaired this meeting now for the last 7 years, this committee, and we also mentor Papua New Guinea. They are associate member as well. Mm. And we mentor there, and we have correspondence going back and forwards. And we've actually had the ministers from Papua New Guinea come to a LAWMAC meeting.
Yeah, fantastic.
And member of parliament. So it's a pretty active group. Mm. This is my last year as chair, and then I'm standing down, letting the younger person come on. We've got a couple of good candidates there.
So you're there's a few last year of chair. It's the last term of council. Does that mean that you're actually going to get ready for some retirement time?
Oh, I don't think. I was only talking to a friend last night. He said, "No, you can't just stop. You got to keep working." I said, "I'll probably get a real job, eh?" Yeah.
So, Alan, you know, you've been here for a long time. You've done a hell of a lot to make change for the Cookshire and for the country, in fact. But for Cape York itself, what do you wish for Cape York into the future? What are some of the things that you would like to see happen? What are your hopes and aspirations for the Cape for the future?
I think it's got to be balanced progress. We've got to allow the people who are residents and permanent residents of the Cape to make a living on the Cape and have some real employment, not living on welfare and just short-term programs. And the only way to do this, allow them to either farm certain areas, picked areas. I don't mean to go in willy-nilly, But there is areas up there that can be utilised for agriculture in a proper balanced manner, proper controlled manner, and to create employment. There's too many communities around the Cape that are non-productive. They're living on welfare and they don't like it. You can talk to them. I employ them. I had one working for me yesterday. He come out and he's been on some program through the community. He just lost the ability to work. He's a young fella, about 26, and for a hard day's work, and they can't handle it. So what we're doing is ruin a generation of youth and people, you know, not just kids. And that there's nothing there for the kids. And all there is drugs and grog and getting into trouble. And we've got to change that. We've got to have a balanced program and have more than just, you know, tourism's great, but not everybody can take part in it. Not everybody can be employed in tourism. We've got to have other stuff.
Need a variety of employment opportunities.
It's good that a lot of people have been getting work and that, but it's got to be ongoing. These programs have got to be ongoing to look after their country and but produce a living out of it. That's the way I see it. When you travel overseas, you don't see the welfare like we got here. People work, you know. They really work. And that's what I'd love to see in this environment, I think.
So, Alan, I've taken up a big chunk of your day here. This is your town day in Cooktown. You've got a few things that you've come in from Laura, which is a good hour and a half.
An hour 40.
Now, you were telling me, just before I let you head off, you were telling me yesterday when I spoke to you, you've been working out in the sun all day, and I'd like you to give us a picture of what working on your property in early December is like in Laura.
Well, it's probably a problem I have. I start doing more work in the middle of summer than what I do for the rest of the year. But I guess it's because council operations wind down a bit and you get more time to put into your own place. And my place is only a Mickey Mouse, 150 acres, but I go around and poison the shrubs on the fence line and keep everything safe from bushfires and so forth, keep a wide break so I can go away and leave it in safety, not worry about it, bushfires not coming in. And I'm always improving, you know, planning something or improving it. I took over a property that had been abandoned, so I've had to rebuild it. So it's just an ongoing program. But it's stupid that I do it in the middle of summer.
Why is that? What are the temperatures like? Tell us what the temperatures
40,
were.
40 plus in the last 2 days.
Yep.
And I tell you, about 11 o'clock, that you don't do much after that.
Yep, I can imagine. Yeah. Well, hopefully you've had a bit of a break from it today, being in Cooktown. It's a little bit steamy sitting here, but...
Oh, this is beautiful.
This is beautiful?
Yeah.
Lovely under the trees here and listening to
in
the
birds. Shade, yeah.
Yeah.
So, Alan, any last words before you go?
I just hope that the state government and the federal government get together and do something constructive for the Cape. Before it gets too late and these people, too many people have ruined their lives with the lack of employment and direction. That's all I can say.
Yep. Thank you so much for your time.
No worries, mate.
Alan Wilson, Cookshire Councillor, speaking to us in the beautiful Botanic Gardens at Cooktown, Cape York Peninsula. Next time, we're off to Cooktown to meet Vince Harrigan, traditional owner from Normanby Station, fantastic musician and a pretty awesome dad.
My tribal areas are from my grandfather's side, the Gugu Yimitir at the Battle Camp Normanby area, Balganwara, and my grandmother, she's a Digarba woman on the Gugu Yalanji side down in the Bloomfield area. Grew up here all my life through my schooling. Done all my schooling here and went away for high school back here again, and now I'm growing my my own family up here now. Yeah, pretty much typical bush kids, fishing, hunting. Spent a lot of time with my grandfather at the station, Normanby, where I am working today. Riding horses, mustering, that sort of stuff. Learning a lot off him, yeah. Whoa, it's a damn big island. You follow us, follow this our
home. Whoa, Australia. My Cape York Life is a podcast made by Cape York Natural Resource Management with support from the Australian Government's National Landcare Program. Look for previous episodes at our website or search My Cape York Life on your favourite podcast app. And you can find Cape York Natural Resource Management on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Lyndall Scoble, and I'll see you next time on My Cape York Life.